Her final breath on this earth was unremarkable, save for the fact that it was her last. Free from struggle or drama, it was as common and miraculous as the sun rising every morning. After the aide had gently raised her bed, she lovingly moistened the mouth, washed the face, and combed the hair. At that moment, she, who was standing close, knew the woman was leaving. Family hurried in, followed by staff, anticipating another breath to follow, which never came. All the while, the music continued uninterrupted to bridge the gap. We froze in a tableau of the gravity and awe in that moment, holding the space. Not 5 minutes later, the person who was the closest to her in the whole world arrived. Again, we held the space and all it contained. Somehow it was overflowing with riches and unspeakably empty at the same moment and filled with light. It is our job to be present to moments like these. Later, we can give them the space to be alone together, to reminisce, to laugh, to cry, to feel. But in this sacred, blessed, infinite moment, we held the space. Please rise if you're able and join me in the opening hymn number 306, Sing of Living, Sing of Dying.
To our worship service at the Theodore Parker Church. My name is Eric Hansen. I've been a member of the church for about 15 years. If you're visiting for the first time, we extend a special welcome to you. Our congregation gathers from a variety of perspectives and religious backgrounds. We come together to learn, to explore religious ideas and moral questions, to grow spiritually, and to gather and rather to care for one another and for our larger community and the world through works of service. Wherever you are on your religious journey, you are welcome here. Whatever your belief or doubt, your culture or circumstances, your sexual orientation or gender identity, everyone is welcome here. And we are glad that you have decided to join us today. If you are new, you will see in the pew rack in front of you a welcome booklet, which you are invited to take, and also a yellow card. If you would like to know more about the Theodore Parker Church or receive our weekly electronic bulletin, you can fill that card out and place it in the collection plate when the offering is taken. Please join us for coffee hour after the service. Follow the crowd through that door, go straight along the breezeway, and up the stairs into the parish hall. Newcomers can look for the welcome table hosted by our membership committee at the coffee hour. And please, everyone, wear your name tag. I also have joined the folks who do not wear their name tag as they make that request of you. Also, please turn off your cell phones and take a moment to look at the announcements at the back of the leaflet, and we'll take any brief announcements from the floor. Are there any announcements? Yes.
Robin Hogro from Music and Worship. This is a new year for us, a transition year, and a lot of things are changing. I just want to really actively solicit people to come tell me about things you think are working well or not working, or things that you'd like to do differently, or things you think are particularly good. We need all the input we can. Thanks.
Hi, Dexter. It's not exactly an announcement. I just want to acknowledge and to thank Jennifer Bottomley, who donated some old sound equipment of hers to the open mic, and we used it for the first time last night. It was a great success, so thank you very much.
Yes. Any other announcements? So I've asked to offer some been asked to offer some personal reflections on the topic for today, and the way that it was presented to me was to talk a little bit about what I have learned from the dying. And there was mention also of the topic on the leaflet, brushing up against the veil on the threshold of life or death, and the way in which today we might think about how that veil is thicker or perhaps less thick, especially as we think about it this time of year. So I'm going to talk a little bit about something that I've actually thought about in the past. This is something of a risk for me. I actually, at the hospital, have been in charge of a monthly rounds that we do in an effort to help people become more sensitive and compassionate caregivers. And so it's a kind of situation in which people are open and revealing about experiences that they've had and feelings that they have. And the hope is that we can engender a kind of environment in which that can happen. But we've also become very aware of the fact that that's a somewhat difficult thing to do in a public situation where you are speaking again with a group of folks. And to talk openly about things that you really feel strongly about and have strong emotions about can be difficult. That you may be inhibited from talking openly about that, again, because you're in a group. So the things that I've been asked to talk about are things that I care a lot about. And as we go along, you'll see that there's actually a lot of sadness and even sorrow in the things that I'm going to discuss. And I may or may not be able to remain composed during the talk that I give. And if I'm not able to remain composed, it's just a measure of how much I care about these things and the kind of experiences I've been through. So, in medical school, I discovered that there were people who were more comfortable and some people who were less comfortable with the dying. And one of the things that the dying taught me that was that I was one of the people who was more comfortable, and rather than moving away from them, I found myself moving towards them. And ultimately, working with the dying became a significant part of my career and a significant part of the experience that I've had. So some of the things that I've learned are these, that although people who are dying all fall in the general category of dying, but the process of dying varies tremendously. And it can vary from the onset of a cancer with slow but steady progression to a recurrence after years or perhaps even decades of remission to a process that's very acute, perhaps months, weeks, days, or even hours. And so that thinking about what kind of dying category that the person is in is an important thing. Also the context. A 82-year-old grandmother who is dying from a disease faces a very different kind of experience than a 32-year-old mother with small children, even though their dying process may be very, very similar in terms of the disease that they have. And the progression of the disease. So, again, one of the things that I've learned from the dying is to try to see them as individuals and to look beyond the kind of disease that they have or even the context they're in and to see them as individuals. The people who are confronted with this kind of experience are able to muster a variety of responses. And that who they are and the kind of experiences that they've had earlier in their lives oftentimes strongly influence or dictate how they can respond. And one of the things that I think about when I'm asked the question about kind of what have I learned about the dying in this area is to think about two episodes that really provide the two ends of the spectrum. One of the things that I learned in dealing with dying folks is to talk with them about the facts of the situation, to really strip away emotion as much as I could, but just talk to them about what the situation was, and then let them provide the emotion to see what kind of response they gave me back as I talked about their situation. And the two ends of the spectrum are these, relatively, I would guess he was probably 55, who looked at me and said, because I would approach the issue gingerly, you know, and I think that people got the sense of that. And so this guy looked at me and he said, "Doc, I'm a big boy. I can handle this." The other end of the spectrum is sitting with a wife and a daughter who the patient was ill enough that he could not be with us. And present the facts and have the wife say, "I can't take this," and to get up and run out of the room. I asked the daughter whether we should run after her, and she said, "No, she'll be okay. You know, I'll go talk to her later." But that's really kind of the two ends of the spectrum. And to be aware of the fact that people may be anywhere along that spectrum is important. My experience has been that denial is oftentimes a big piece of how people deal with this experience initially. But that the dying process is actually a process. And one of the things that happens is that denial oftentimes becomes less, there is more resolution, sometimes there's acceptance. One of the things, again, that I've learned is that the ability of people to really deny is in direct measure to how sick they are. And where they are in the process. And it's a pretty remarkable thing to have people be really sick and continue to deny and really need to rely on that to deal with the situation. Again, in terms of the context and where you are with this, talking with people initially about it, what's called in the trade as giving bad news, is a special kind of experience and really requires a special sensitivity and a special set of skills. It's pleasing to me to know that medical schools have taken this on as a responsibility and that medical students are taught specifically to try to increase their sensitivity and skills in this area. And one of the things that people are taught is that once you make the diagnosis and give the bad news, that people simply may not be able to hear much of anything else. And what you have to say in terms of, you know, the logistics or whatever simply may not be absorbed, and it's really a measure of how powerfully influenced people can be by having you share that information with them. I've come to respect that in a way that I didn't in the past. When we talk about denial, oftentimes it's with something of a negative connotation that people really should accept, you know, what it is they're trying to deny. But one of the things that I've come to understand is that what we are telling them is that the kind of attachments that they have to their own life and to others are being threatened. And of course, attachment is something that we want for people. We want people to care about their own lives. We want people to care about their experience. We want people to care about others. If people can't do that, we say that they have an attachment problem. It's a difficulty. And so that I've come to value and respect the person's difficulty when that's threatened in a way that I did not before I began to have this experience. I've also come to learn that death is not the singular isolated experience that I expected that it would be. People will sometimes say colloquially that, you know, death is something that other people can't do for you. You know, you have to do, it's one of the things that you have to do by yourself, or you know, for yourself. And certainly that's true on one level, but another way it's really not true. That the attachments that I just talked about have other people on the other side. And that when somebody has a diagnosis of a terminal illness, then those attachments, the people on the other side, then of course are involved. And that family, either by blood or by choice, is very important in terms of how they respond. Sometimes those responses can be supportive, other times they're not, and they can be unhelpful or even destructive. And that one of the things that I've learned to do is to really watch out and to realize that family interactions in a situation like that may not be productive, and there needs to be some action on the part of the patient to actually protect them. So, again, as I said, one of the things that working with the dying has taught me is that they are connected not only to family, but also to society in general and to healthcare providers specifically. And then, as I said earlier, some people will move towards the dying and other people will move away. And I think that it's unfortunate that we as healthcare providers, as a corporate body, are not as sensitive to the dying as we should be. And one of the phrases that has gained currency, because I think that it is the attitude of some healthcare providers, is there's nothing more that we can do for you. And I think that what that phrase says is that, you know, there's nothing more in the kind of routine medical behaviors that we can engage in that are indicated for you. But that beyond that the individual and likely their family has many more needs. And the ability to know that and to connect with that is an important thing, both for medical providers and also for others involved in the care of the individual. I've come to think about the process that the individual goes through and the others connected with them as involving what I've come to phrase as a social death, that there are social deaths that happen. And one of those social deaths is the turning away that happens. The medical providers who really can't see beyond what their narrow medical responsibilities are, but also others. I mean, certainly it's well known that people who have a terminal illness sometimes are confronted with a situation where those who have been close to them and provided for them or been friends simply are uncomfortable. You know, we don't know what to say. We don't know what to do. And so what happens is that there's a break and isolation and a kind of social death that happens. And I think being aware of that and being especially supportive because of that is important. One of the most important things I think that the dying have taught me is that I also have had my own limitations. And that although I was more comfortable than others and also attracted to working with the dying, I also had my limitations. And becoming aware of where it is that I, again, the phrase that I use, turned away when I could actually remain in contact, in touch with the individual, the family, was an important thing. And over time, I worked on that as an issue. And ultimately got to the point, one of the things I recognized was that the times that I turned away, I believe, were times when I felt that if I took an action that I might get a response that would cause me to not be able to maintain my professional composure. and that I would lead the conversation into a situation where it was just emotionally provocative enough for me that I simply was not going to be able to maintain my composure. And I have mixed feelings about that. I do think that there is a good reason for professionals to not break down in front of their patients. I think that isn't necessarily a good thing for patients. But at the same time, recognizing that there was the possibility of me really working in on that as an issue and becoming more capable there was important, and I did work on that, and ultimately got to the point where I could ask questions, open-ended questions, that really allowed people to become emotional, and I could have them even break down and cry in my presence, and I might weep a tear or two, but I was able to maintain my composure in a way that I couldn't have earlier in my career, and it's certainly one of the things that I value about the experience, both in terms of what I did, but also being able to share that experience with people and to be able to really allow them to open up and to let me know how strongly they felt about the experience. So in 1982, I graduated from my residency program in internal medicine, and I went looking for a job. And the job that I got actually was a real interesting one. It was in a community health center in downtown Boston. It's the Fenway Community Health Center. And it was with this subculture of folks that I hadn't had a lot of experience with, and that was the gay and lesbian community. Nice folks, interesting people. Worked out of a basement, funky kind of situation, they accepted me as a heterosexual man. There was, openness. and again, this was in the summer of 1982. So about 2 weeks after I got there, three of the men from the community came to me and said, there's this funny thing going on in the gay male community. Excuse me. There are these diseases that are happening that are odd and people don't really understand them. And so that was my first awareness of what ultimately became the AIDS epidemic. The next 4 years that I spent there were focused in large measure on responding to that experience. And it was a really remarkable experience in a number of ways. One of which was people were dying, and we did not know why initially. When people began to focus on it and really kind of put two and two together, the smart ones figured out that it was because of a bloodborne virus. But it took a long time for people to shift the focus away from what was called GRIDS, gay-related immune deficiency, because of drugs and, sex and a whole lot of variety of things that people wanted to focus on other than what was really happening. So it was a remarkable experience in terms of an education about the awareness of death and how people respond. For 2 years, I had a steady stream of very anxious, highly anxious young men who were healthy coming to sit with me asking whether they were dying. And I wasn't able to tell them yes or no. I could give them an estimate based on what their behavior was and how likely they might be exposed, those kinds of things. In 1984, process of working this through and identifying the virus had been complete to the point where we were able then to draw blood and do a blood test to see whether or not people actually had the virus. And so at that point, I had a steady stream of men sit with me to get the results of the test and to ask again whether they were dying. It was a remarkable experience in terms of the individuals and kind of how they dealt with this experience. They were young, they were healthy, they didn't have any symptoms, but they might well have been diagnosed with what ultimately was to be a terminal disease. So dealing with that, their awareness of death and the fact that they might have a terminal disease in the face of good health was a kind of pretty remarkable experience. We had a strong mental health arm, as you might expect. We had folks who supported these individuals. But one of the things that was really remarkable to me was the response, one, of the larger community, those who lived through that remember some of the really terrible things that happened in response to all of this, and two, the response of the gay and lesbian community and those of us who were sympathetic to all of this, and the way that people came together in what was a really terrible situation, and that the community awareness of death and the threat of death and the actual illness and death of members and how they responded to that was a really admirable thing. And my participation in that is something that I value, and as well I admire the community response to that as well. So, it made the point to me that death can be unexpected, but even kind of the whole awareness of whether or not you are in a situation where you might have a terminal illness can be unexpected, and kind of what to do in a situation where you're healthy, but you've been told that you might be terminally ill is again, it was a remarkable thing for me. So, when I was younger, before I went to medical school, I actually had an experience that stayed with me. It was with a psychotherapist who ran psychodrama sessions. And I don't know if people know about psychodrama, but basically it's kind of a situation where you do a scene, essentially like a dramatic scene from a play, and you, an individual is the protagonist, and that they share enough with the individuals to know what the situation is, and then they play out a scene. So I actually worked with her and with the psychodrama group for a year. And it was one of the most powerful and engaging experiences that I've ever had. I really took to it and found it a really remarkable experience. The leader was very good, very insightful, but also sometimes in the interest of therapy was open about things that were cutting and hurtful. And so I developed a relationship with her that was very two-sided. So this experience was powerful enough, so it stayed with me for decades. And I oftentimes compare it to the kind of experience that I had of my parents, where, love and support, but also they do some stuff that's not so good, and that stays with you, and oftentimes your lifetime. This experience was like that. And on the whole, it was a really good experience. And the experience oftentimes would play itself out in terms of offering a perspective on something that I was experiencing in the present moment. That Hannah and my experience with her would kind of be there in a really lively way as I thought about and experience this new experience that was happening. So the last time I saw her was in 1975. In 1995, a compatriot of hers came to Boston, and under the auspices of one of the outfits here, ran a psychodrama session. And so I said, wow, I need to go to that. And so I went. And actually did play the role of the protagonist with this individual. I had a good psychodrama session. And afterwards, I spoke to her and said, you know, that I had been worked with Hannah Weiner. And how was she? And her response was that, oh, she died. She died in the mid-1970s. And I was just very much taken aback by that, first of all. But the experience that I had after that was very interesting, which is that this kind of bright, lively experience that I was having simply went like this. And it just kind of tailed off and became much less dramatic, much less intense than it had been in the past. And the experience provoked me to think about what it means to be alive to someone. So here I was in this situation where this person and this experience that was really a lively and important part of my experience was there with me, but that the person who had provoked it was dead. And she was not only dead, but she had been dead for decades. And so, again, an interesting thing about it is that once I knew that she was dead, that deadened the experience for me, and that it really tailed off. And in response to the business about the veil, about kind of the thickness and the thinness of the veil, and how much in contact we are with the dying, it's something that was dramatic and really interesting to me. And I'm not exactly sure what to make of it, but certainly the idea of being in contact and feeling the liveliness of somebody who was dead and dead a long time is just, again, very striking to me. My dad died in August. He was 93. He lived a long, full life. He donated his body to medical science, so there was no immediate funeral. We had a memorial service 2 weeks after he died. I gave the remarks for the family. So I had about 2 weeks to kind of mull over what my remarks were going to be. And I spent a lot of time thinking about it. My dad's relationship with me also had two sides. There was a loving side, and then there was a side that was harsh and insensitive in a way that was not good for me when I was a kid. So I've had mixed feelings throughout the whole of my life. It was interesting to kind of go through that two-week period, think about things, spend a lot of time crying, and ultimately come to a set of remarks that actually focused on the good things about his life, his sense of humor, the way that he supported us, and to have people really respond to that and agree. And again, it was an interesting thing about how, for me, about how my dad was dead, but nonetheless the veil between the two of us got thinner. He was no longer there, but that I was able to get closer to him after he died, and I went through the process that I just described. So one of the things that I thought about as I mused about these experiences and making these remarks is William Faulkner's quote. Of course, he was the man who talked about, or rather wrote about the influence of the past on the present and the self. And his quote was, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." So, I think that in some ways, the dead are always with us. We are their progeny. And the kind of veil that we have between them and us, in large measure, is dictated by us in terms of how we think about them and how we relate to them.
Chalice lighting is number 468. We need one another. It's a responsive reading. Do this seated. We need one another when we mourn and would be comforted. We need one another when we are in despair, in temptation, and need to be recalled to our best selves again. We need one another in the hour of success when we look for someone to share our triumphs.
We need one another in the hour of defeat when the courage we might endure and stand again.
We need one another when we come to die and would have gentle hands prepare us for the journey.
All our lives we are needy, and others are in need of us.
At this point in the service, you will have candles, our usual candles of joy and concern, candles of reflection and remembrance. This is the service closest to Halloween and Samhain, when my tradition of the veil between life and death is thin. So in particular, people have reflections or thoughts about those close to them on the other side of the veil. Please come forward and either speak to us or reflect silently on those things.
As many of you know from the caring ministry, Susan Karen's mother died this past week. And I don't have the arrangements at this point, but she did ask that you remember her and her family and her mother in your prayers. In addition, one of my friends, her sister, is a Christian Scientist, and she had a medically treatable illness that she has not treated and therefore has a terminal prognosis, which is causing great distress for all concerned. And I would like for you to hold her and her family in your prayers.
My name is Rebecca. I want to light this candle for my stepfather, Fred, who had quite an unusual journey. He had Alzheimer's and he disappeared. Seven years ago. And they just found his remains. And he came back to us October 10th. So, he was a great stepfather to me.
John Thompson, Spirit of the Theme, Death and Dying, 88, going on 89, and what I wanted to say was I lost, not lost, but they're still around me, two wives. One used to come to this church, and after she died, I took a one-day trip to Grand Canyon with a Hopi Indian man, 45, who really enlightened me at that time of loss, selfish loss in terms of personally, and then losing two wives. And every day people say to me, well, where's your wife? Well, she's in the great spirit land, because this Hopi Indian just 5 years ago straightened me out. In our culture, and we just get older and older, and then sometimes we just walk outside and go into the other land and become part of the great spirit. So that's my spirit now, and just commend that idea to you. Thank you.
Haskell, and I wanted to light a candle for my mother, who's on this side of the veil, and how she maybe daily thinks of her dead and speaks to them, and has since she was or since they weren't with her anymore in their bodies. So she's come home from 5 months in different rehabs and hospitals, and she's sleeping in the living room in a comfy bed, and it's possible to reach through that veil, at least in her case.
Sunil Sareen. I want to take this occasion to remember several people close to me and other members of my family in roughly chronological order. My younger brother Sonny, my first wife Leslie, my father, my father-in-law, my mother-in-law, my best friend Saj, Beatrice Imperiali, and several members of the Bhargava family.
Experience of experiencing from beyond the veil is with my father, who died some years ago now. He was a powerful, commanding figure and was enraged and humiliated by the devastation of Lou Gehrig's disease as he gradually lost his ability to be autonomous. He shot himself to end his life, and in retrospect, meticulously planned everything, getting his financial affairs in order, making sure to do it in such a way that was beneficial for the taxes, for the children, all sorts of things that I had no idea, and had methodically planned the whole thing to call 911 just before he did it. For him, the loss of autonomy was worse than any possible thing that could happen from the disease. But I still startle myself. I speak in his cadence, and I suddenly hear his voice. I strike some sort of pose that I see, and it's his. And I have an extremely strong sense of him being there. So on today, days like today, where we talk about the veil between life and death, we have a very real and palpable sense that I know what that means. I'll light one more candle for all the thoughts and reflections that remain unspoken in our hearts today.
In the interest of time, I think we're going to move a little bit forward, so I'm going to give my reflections. But I wanted to start with the words of Woody Allen, who said, "I'm not afraid of dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens." For nearly 20 years, I've been playing music at the bedside for people at the end of life. Currently, I coordinate a palliative care program similar to hospice. Over the years, I've been present for what could be considered both good and bad deaths. The average age of the population I work with is about 85 to 95 years old. Often, their decline happens slowly over a long period of time. Becoming familiar with this stage of life has made me less scared of dying and enhanced my faith in something beyond this existence. It is oddly life-affirming to be around people that are on the precipice of the great mystery. The life force is remarkably strong. Have you ever been struck by the sheer will of nature when you see green leaves growing through cracks in an asphalt driveway? After a lifetime of striving for good health, people need time to transition when the goal of care shifts from fighting a disease to comfort care. Patients and their loved ones often go through different stages when they're faced with terminal diagnosis. They enter into an emotional process that takes time and layers of adjustment and come to terms with the ending of their lives. People may experience upheaval or crisis. Families gather, but they may need to navigate complex relationships that have been strained in the past. Some families can be brought to a place of healing through this process, and some are torn further apart. Eventually, they may or may not rally to cope with the situation. Hopefully, they will move into a place of peace or acceptance, but not always. It's a journey that can often be long and difficult in its process. At such a sacred and delicate time as the ending of a life, it feels important to hold the space and all that it contains. The phrase "holding the space" from the opening words is intriguing because of it is an oxymoron. How can one hold space? To me, it means non-judgmental witnessing, an acceptance of where people are in the process. It means being fully present and having faith that even in death there can be healing. To remain present to suffering is a spiritual path. A hospice nurse once told me about a vision one of her patients had. The patient was lucid and knew that she was nearing the end of her life. One day when the nurse visited her, the woman said, "Who is that standing beside you?" Luckily, the nurse had the presence of mind not to say, "There's no one in the room but you and me." Instead, she said, "Describe them to me." The patient described a being that was covered in white feathers, but they wouldn't show her their face. Then the nurse said, "Maybe when you're ready to go, they will show you their face." The woman died a few days later. It's a beautiful example of holding the sacred space, honoring and validating the person's process, regardless of whether she understood it or not, and being present to their experience. One woman I'm working with was recently diagnosed with cancer so advanced that she was given about a month to live. She accepted this news with great grace and said that the one thing she wanted to do before she died was to vote for Obama. I'm happy to say that she got her wish this week. In the days before their death, people often seem to be doing deep internal work on some level. They sometimes withdraw their attention from the conversation of visitors in the room and enter into their own world. I've seen people moving their hands as if they're swimming through something. People have commented about seeing departed loved ones and had other unexplainable otherworldly experiences. In the responsive reading about change that we read last week, it said, "The beginning of a circle is also its end." Could the reverse of that be said, that the end of the circle is also its beginning? Sometimes I have observed that people who have a belief that something of themselves will live on after death have a deeper sense of comfort than those who believe that this is the end of their existence. But just this week, that same person who wanted so desperately to vote told me that she believes she will cease to exist after she dies, and she was completely at peace with that. Since none of us truly knows what lies beyond, and since we can find evidence to support virtually anything, any theory out there, I sometimes wonder why not choose to believe something that makes us feel good and gives us comfort. Years ago, after my father died, I found comfort in reading Raymond Moody's Life After Life book. It's a compilation of accounts from people who have had near-death experiences. Many described having similar visions, including life review, a bright light, and going to a different place of existence. Recently, on the cover of Newsweek, there was an article written by a neurosurgeon named Dr. Eben Alexander. He had a bacterial infection that shut down his neocortex, and while in a coma for a week, he describes going to a place where there was a deep acceptance and love, light, colors, and sounds. There were higher beings who communicated through thought, even though his physical brain was incapable of thinking while his cortex was offline. He considers this proof that there is a heaven beyond this world. Some deeply religious people who have had near-death experiences see Jesus as in the 4-year-old boy whose father wrote the book Heaven is for Real, and the evangelical minister Don Piper, who wrote a book called 90 Minutes in Heaven. He described a shimmering city with gates and his loved ones there to greet him. I wonder sometimes if what we believe is what happens to us when we die. If you believe in pearly gates, maybe that's what you'll get. There's a wonderful lecture available online through the TED Talks called My Stroke of Insight, in which Jill Bolte Taylor, a neuroanatomist and brain researcher, describes what she experienced when she had a massive stroke. Her consciousness switched between the left and right hemispheres of her brain. The analytical side knew that she had to get help, but it would go offline, and the intuitive side of her brain became dominant and thrust her into an experience of the vastness of the universe. She tearfully expresses how beautiful and expansive it was to feel nirvana. If you get nothing else out of today's service, I hope that you will listen to this moving and inspiring account of her experience. It is well worth it. The mysteries that lie beyond what we can know are intriguing. On a more tangible level, it's hard to imagine how each one of us will face the end of our lives when our time comes. Will we have unfinished business to put in order? Will we feel complete and content with our lives? Will we have regrets and wish we'd done things differently? Will we be surrounded by our loved ones? Will we cling to life and run from death's grip, or will we face it head on? None of us can know what's in store for us. All we can do is live fully in each moment and be willing to sit with the mystery that is this life.
Now we will gratefully receive your offerings to continue the good works of this church. Our offertory dedication is in the insert in your leaflet. This is arranged by our own Michael Johnson. In the interest of time, I'll spare you my personal reflection at length. You can, by all means, ask me. I'll just say that as a clever but not particularly deep young geek, I was unprepared as a medical student in San Francisco in the early 1980s for the waves and waves of young men dying far before their time. But ill-equipped as I was, from that experience, I gained my adult voice and the way you see me now, and learned to live life not in denial of, but in the presence of death. So I'll give you instead the much more eloquent words of Khalil Gibran from the Prophet, which, because I forgot to bring my reading, I will read for you from my iPhone. From the Prophet, he asks, "Speak to us of death. You would know the secret of death, but how shall you find it unless you seek it in the heart of life? The owl, whose night-bound eyes are blind unto the day, cannot unveil the mystery of light. If you would indeed behold the spirit of death, open your heart wide unto the body of life, for life and death are one, even as the river and the sea are one. In the depths of your hopes and desires lies your silent knowledge of the beyond. And like seeds dreaming beneath the snow, your heart dreams of spring. Trust the dreams, for in them is hidden the gate to eternity. Your fear of death is but the trembling of the shepherd when he stands before the king whose hand is to be laid upon him in honor. Is the shepherd not joyful beneath his trembling that he shall wear the mark of the king? Yet is he not more mindful of his trembling? For what is it to die but to stand naked in the wind and to melt into the sun? And what is it to cease breathing, but to free the breath from its restless tides, that it may rise and expand and seek God unencumbered? Only when you drink from the river of silence shall you indeed sing. And when you have reached the mountaintop, then you shall begin to climb. And when the earth shall claim your limbs, then shall you truly dance." Our closing hymn is number 324, "Where My Free Spirit Onward Leads." Please rise as you are able and join us.
Thank you.
Whether the twilight was the ending of the day or the beginning of the night. And then suddenly, one day, I understood that this did not matter at all, for time is but a circle, and there can be no beginning and no ending. And this is how I came to know that birth and death are one, and it is neither the coming or the going that is of consequence. What is of consequence is the beauty that one gathers in this interlude called life. And so I have slowly come to understand that beauty has a thousand different faces: stark branches against a wintry sky, a snowdrop welcoming the spring, the delicate tracery of a spider web, the rich fragrance of the damp woods, the timpani of distant thunder, and yes, do not forget the dusty pink and molten golds of the sunset, the music of raindrops upon the leaves, the sleepy call of a robin in the gathering dusk, and the glittering stars that fill the darkness with the symbols of time and space unending. Beauty holds a thousand different faces toward the searching heart. May it be so. Please be seated.